Hey, everybody. This is Alex Swatz, and I am the host of the Highly Endofuncturing Individuals podcast. With me today, I have Mai, who is the founder, CEO, and maybe also intern of Curvance. Mr. Mai, I would love to learn more about you.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on. Obviously, big fan of everything you're doing and, you know, everything that Fastlane does as well. As you said, been building Curvance for a while. We're ticked into our 36th month now, so 3 years officially building out Curvance, which is absolutely insane to say. And finally coming to market here soon. Excited to, talk and happy to dive into, myself, Curvance, the future and everything in between.
Hell yeah. So like for the people that aren't aware, Curvance, and Mai, please correct me if I'm wrong about this. Aren't you guys the top app on Monad right now by like transaction count?
Yeah. I think there's a few teams that have been doing a lot of good work there. I think, there's a few apps that have like 30, 40, 50 million transactions. I think we passed 250 million now. One of the crazy metrics that I saw is that over the last month, in testnet, we've been doing around 29 TPS, which I think is higher than some layer twos. From an infrastructure perspective, we're basically up to par with some like layer one, layer two blockchains. Maybe not, a lot of these like super performant L1s, obviously, but was a cool little, statistic there, which was really born out of like a need for us to test our own technology. Like we built this wallet abstracted game called Pump for Games, which is very basic. It basically generates a wallet for you. You tap it and every tap is a transaction. So it's not, not as complicated as like a DEX swap or, some like leverage borrowing position or something like that. But it's something interactive that lets us, test our own infrastructure, test the Monad infrastructure, and, allowed us to kind of sneak out some of these, consumer-facing features that we wanted, like an achievement system, a live leaderboard, unlockables, and then obviously like the wallet abstraction side. Although we'll probably use like a more conventional turnkey, privy, those types of solutions in the future.
That's really interesting. So like, I think one of the questions we usually ask people on this show is why Monad? And I think in your case, it's literally because a lot of like the more legacy, L1s and L2s, your TPS is too high for that. And I think that's like kind of cool. I'd love to like, and I plan to dive more into that. But before we start doing that, I'd love to learn a little bit more about your background, because before you started like, the most active app on Monad, you were, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were working in TradFi?
Yeah, that's correct. So my history was I started in engineering, like very traditional, path to, it was in computer engineering. So it would have put me on a path to somewhere like NVIDIA or something, which would have been great, obviously, seeing how that company has done the last decade or so, in like fabrication and hands-on hardware. But I was much more interested in like these more complicated, problems, like optimization problems, as I would describe it, which is like very vague, but like, I was, putting transistors on a breadboard and, doing like logic, type stuff, but also programming and stuff, but it didn't feel as impactful as I really wanted it to be, or as impactful as I thought it could be. And, my dad worked in traditional finance as well, but on the technical side. So he helped build data centers for companies. So like if you had some, hedge fund or large bank, that basically had a need for, systems that never went down, right? He would be the type of person you'd bring in to kind of build that whole operation. And he introduced me to a number of traders. Funnily enough, at a hedge fund that a lot of people have differing opinions about now, which is George Soros's hedge fund. So I had spoken to some of the traders there, and the problems they, were talking about day to day just were a lot more interesting than what it felt like I was doing in my undergrad. So I dropped out of engineering and basically went into finance. So then I went through like a more conventional, like quant, I guess, like education there, you know, so a lot of math, a lot of statistics, programming, stuff like that. And then I worked at a hedge fund, volatility hedge fund. I built a systematic trading algorithm there. So basically, when companies would be merging together, you know, it is an instant, right? Like two companies would say, hey, we want to merge together. And then they would need to get it approved, but they would announce that they intend to be, you know, merged together before the acquisition, you know, took place generally for publicly traded companies anyway, right? Which is differ to like a private company. So the model would basically look at what the potential likelihood of the deal going through was based on, you know, some characteristic, some like big data model that I built. And, you know, it spit out basically percentage. And, you know, if the market was pricing a deal going through with 50% likelihood and the model predicted 85%, well, then that was good to long, right? Or in the reverse, if we thought there was a 2% chance of it going through and the market was pricing it at 80, maybe you would want to, you know, go short that, right? Now, of course, like generally a lot of these funds want to go like long bias. So that was like less common. But that was the idea of the premise. So that was it when I was in investments. And then I moved over to trading at an asset manager and did a lot of big data, machine learning, you know, models, a lot of the precursors to like the GPTs and stuff people use today in some form, you know, so it was like natural language processing stuff, you know, different like ensemble tree models, you know, neural nets, like stuff like that. Also linear models, you know, there'd be some cases where you do like basic, like a regression analysis or something because they don't want to touch like some of the newer stuff and, or even, you know, just totally not, you know, linear models that are like really boring, you know, just like average these numbers and output it. But it was, you know, working with traders, portfolio managers, trying to basically help them execute better. How do you price something, bonds that haven't traded in a month? How do you, you know, sell $1 billion of different futures contracts without, you know, moving the market? Right. So things like that.
So there's a lot to unpack there. I think that I could go into like a lot of those individual subjects and we could probably talk about them for hours because that's like very, very interesting. But one of the things that I would like in that background, one of the things that really jumped out to me is like very interesting in regards to like the current crypto environment and like kind of like the hot narratives in crypto right now is this aspect of, you know, your original thing where you're looking at like M&A and you're anticipating whether the merger will go through. I'm imagining maybe that there would be some like, you know, maybe regulatory concerns about whether it could go through or if it's more of like a financial thing. If like you're looking at the spreadsheets back in my day, as we used to use, I imagine you guys are the ones that put my class of people kind of surveilled.
I mean, you know, depending on the, you know, PM, like, some of them wanted Excel only, their Bloomberg terminal. They're like, fuck you, I'm not using anything else.
That's awesome. But like, let me ask you this, because like, I feel like that seems like very much so the kind of thing that today people would be looking at prediction markets for. You know, your things like your Polymarket or your Opinion Labs. And I guess my question for you is like, when you look at the prediction markets today, do you see like areas that may have overlapped with what you were doing before?
That's a really good question. I think you're talking very, you know, like a lot broader, you know, like ocean, right? A prediction market is predicting anything, right? And one of those predictions could be companies merging together. So I don't see why you couldn't have that. You know, I think it just then becomes a game of liquidity, right? Because typically the strategy, and this is not like, you know, special information or anything, but the typical strategy for when companies would merge together would be you would long the company being purchased and short the company buying them, right? So it'd be like basically like almost like a pair trade, as people would say, like, oh, like ETH BTC is down so much, right? That's kind of like you're longing Bitcoin and shorting ETH, or in the case where it went down here, longing ETH and shorting Bitcoin, and then you lost all your money. In that case, you could trade like the full float of the publicly traded company, right? Which is billions, tens of billions, potentially hundreds of billions of dollars of liquidity. Whereas prediction market is obviously, you know, like an order book. It's a lot smaller. So I would imagine the big difference is going to be, you know, one, the liquidity, but also two, probably like some degree of like your counterparty, right? Like you'd anticipate the counterparty in a publicly traded environment to be a lot more sophisticated than maybe like a bit more like esoteric or fringe, you know, like technology, at least broadly, right? Obviously, a lot of people know Polymarket and these different types of things, but still like relatively fringe versus like the whole stock market. So I think the two things there, liquidity and like your counterparty. So there's probably more upside for something like that if people actually started trying to make markets like that on something like Polymarket, because you could get like a better counter, you know, like a less sophisticated counterparty there. But it would probably be really hard to like get any meaningful size.
Would it be safe to assume that like as it is right now, the like trades would be too capacity constrained to like be profitable for a larger team with like built-out infra?
Yeah, I mean, it's sizing, right? Like if they wanted to directionally bet, you know, very heavily, like there wouldn't be even like a hundredth as much liquidity as maybe they would need.
Got it. Yeah. And I think like MEV in particular in a lot of the ecosystems we've looked at suffers from like a very similar thing where you see a lot of these, you know, one man or like, you know, like two person shops or five person shops where they just can't hire more because of the capacity constraints. And like one of the things that I think is interesting and that I think that you guys are playing a potentially huge role in is just bringing in more liquidity to a lot of these ecosystems, Monad in particular, which will bring in more capacity, and that capacity then brings in more sophisticated operations, and then the sophisticated operations potentially bring in, you know, better price discovery. My next question for you is like, your background sounds like very fascinating to me. I think you've got a very well-rounded skill set. Like you were doing all of the most interesting parts of TradFi. And
Nice of you to say.
It's very cool to me anyway. Maybe, you know, I'm a bit nerdy about this kind of thing, but like that's a very impressive background to me. So my question for you is, what made you leave that to start building in DeFi?
Honestly, the same thing that made me change from engineering initially, right, is this idea of like trying to solve bigger problems, right? So even when you're at like a large asset manager and, you know, you're like, oh, well, like my impact here, you know, through integrating, you know, the whatever technology things, you know, the thing that I delivered this year or, you know, last year to this year, we saw trading costs for these particular assets, you know, go down by 12%, you know, like across slippage or whatever, you know, like the time of day execution has been better. Like the way we, you know, like the different algorithms that we use to, you know, get in and out of these positions, or, you know, like a high touch, low touch, you know, peer to peer, like talking with a person, you know, calling them like through Bloomberg or something, like versus like an electronic venue. Like all those things are interesting, like they're improvements, and they're a lot bigger than me, you know, putting, you know, together like logic gates or something. But they're not quite as big as building like a, you know, I don't know, like a financial industry on chain. Right. Like it's not about like building like a neobank or something on chain, or like a stock, like everyone talks about decentralized NASDAQ. Right. Or, you know, somebody is like, those are huge problems, like to maybe not problems in the general sense. Right. Because NASDAQ as it is today works perfectly fine. But like there's this potential opportunity to create something better, you know, for everyone globally, right? With this whole idea of like freedom to transact, that anyone could access this technology. To me, that's just a lot more compelling than me getting better and better and better at, you know, reducing like trading costs, for example.
Makes a lot of sense to me. How did you find the transition? Like, were there any surprises, anything unexpected as you were going from TradFi to DeFi?
Yeah, well, I would say the biggest thing has just been like absolutely chewing glass the last few years, because like when I first started building Curvance the week after Luna collapsed, and then when we first tried to get like some, you know, angel capital in and stuff for like some initial like, hey, we should actually, you know, do like some legal entity stuff and like, you know, bring on, you know, a little bit more like help. So like, you know, you're just not like one dude, you know, coding at his desk and doing everything. FTX collapsed, right? And then like it's been like a series of like traumatic events. We basically build through like the whole like bear market period. And obviously, like as we're building things, we see like the kind of rogue agency through like the SEC just like going after, you know, all these companies that are like doing their best to be legally compliant. Well, yeah, you know, I would say the majority of them, like Coinbase and stuff like that, probably more so than like Celsius or even some of these other parties, which are like those are like actual fraud, right? Oh, you know. Maybe not 100% hit rate one way or the other.
There were a lot of bad people that the SEC went after. There were a handful of good people that the SEC also went after.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate way to describe it. But yeah, so a lot of bear market building, I guess, was the big transitional phase. It's like, you know, oh, like this is a great time to like build new technology. And then it's like a year later, like, hey, where did everyone go? You know, like.
Have you... When you initially started, were you like raising right after the Luna collapse?
Like, yeah. So basically like Luna into FTX, because like that was like around the same time, right? Like they were pretty close together. So it was like in between Luna and FTX and then after FTX. Yeah. So there was definitely like, you know, like we would get like someone that wanted to angel invest and they'll be like, oh, well, I just lost all my money in Luna. And I'm like, oh, fuck.
Yeah. Yeah, us too, actually. That's when we first did our first round, and it was so painful.
Yeah, I can't imagine. It was probably even worse on the venture side, because like for them, you know, a lot of the venture, you know, teams were like very heavily involved with Luna, you know, and using like UST and stuff like that, you know, whereas like it was much more isolated than for like individuals. Because we were going with angels and stuff. We didn't do like venture initially.
So let me ask you this. So like you guys, you know, you really sharpened your teeth during the bear market. You survived and you guys are now thriving. Let me ask you, like, what do you think is the, like, if you had to pick just one, like, what would you say is like one of the main reasons why you guys have succeeded during what is, you know, arguably one of the most difficult times to differentiate yourself from the competition?
Yeah, I think it's just tenacity, you know, is like the one word I would describe it. But, you know, it's like in an industry, you know, it's obviously very in its infancy, right? And as we saw with like the dot-com bubble, although that was a bit before my time, you know, there was a period of people, you know, that would be able to raise a lot of capital, have highly valued companies for just having like a website, right? Like there's always the example like pets.com and stuff like that. And I think crypto has very much been in that same, you know, kind of trajectory, right? I don't know if we're pre.com bubble or post. I guess time will tell. But, you know, I think there's the same kind of thing of like authenticity is rare. And, you know, tenacity when everyone's looking for like short-term payoffs is, you know, something that people look for, right? So we're like a team that, you know, has been basically chewing glass for, you know, 3 years now. You know, we could have easily launched like a, you know, product that was like incrementally better, launched a token, probably done really well, especially like, you know, in the like post-election, you know, run-up that we had last year. But like, that's not what we're trying to do, right? Like we have a vision for, you know, the product we want to build, where we think the industry is going and our part in it. And we want to do that right. So, you know, it's much more about coming out of the gate, which is kind of counter to conventional startups, right? Conventional startup logic is, you know, move really fast, launch a small product, get users, and then iterate, right? Which does not work at all in crypto, except in maybe very isolated cases. Like I think Pump Fun would be an example where that popped off very heavily initially, and then they were able to turn it into, you know, more iteratively. But there's like a graveyard of teams that have released like a pretty good product and then just couldn't, you know, keep users in the door. People lost their attention and went to other things, right? So tenacity is important and, you know, authenticity is important.
That really strikes a chord with me because I feel like especially during that period, there were just a lot of teams that had just like forked some other repo. And I feel like in your segment, in your vertical, there are, you know, like Aave, Compound, and there must be dozens of like, you know, forks of those two. But then you guys went in a very like different direction and your technology is quite different. And I'd love to learn more about like what exactly those differences are and how those differences have played into your success?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, definitely more than a dozen forks. I think there's like more than like 70 forks of just Compound V2 by itself. So definitely, and that kind of was annoying for us too. Because like there'd be a lot of people that would come up with like this new lending protocol or something. They'd release it and, you know, someone would look at them and then look at us and be like, well, why were they able to launch their thing like so much quicker? It's like, well, because they just copied someone else's code and then changed it around a little bit. And a lot of them got exploited, you know, and then like basically blew up because they didn't even understand the code that they were working with, right? They used just someone else's work, made some modifications on top, didn't understand the repercussions of that, and then basically exploded, right? Which is, of course, where Mark at Aave always says, just use Aave, right? Which is like a great tagline because, you know, like you have all these people that try to emulate them, but you should just use the real thing, right? And that's very much a similar opinion to, you know, the way we conduct ourselves, right? Like we don't want to be Aave. We don't want to, you know, kind of make some incremental or differentiating, you know, product in the same, you know, exact vertical as these guys. We're Curvance, we're our own thing. And the original idea was around this idea that my co-founder, this question that my co-founder had, which was basically like he'd been using, you know, things like, you know, ETH and Aave, Cream, and, you know, Compound, some of these money markets, right? And was able to borrow against like his ETH, you know, his pile of ETH, and then go and borrow some stable coins and play in like DeFi summer, right? And then the question was like, okay, well, now you have all these new assets. You have like Curve, you have Yearn, you have Badger, you know, Balancer, like all these things that like are these more sophisticated assets and, you know, you could do cool things with them. And he was like, well, why can't I borrow against those assets too, right? So a very simple question. Right. Which to me is just fundamentally like in TradFi, you would look at that as rehypothecation, right? Where someone lends someone money, securitizes it, and then sells that debt to someone else. And, you know, then that gets rehypothecated. And then eventually you get, you know, the financial crisis and the entire industry explodes, right? In like 2007, 2008. So avoiding that part, but usually it's very common, very popular to be able to do something, you know, tokenize it in our case, or securitize it in the TradFi land, and then kind of move it further down the stack, right? So that was the impetus for Curvance, right? And to do that, we needed a lot different architecture. You know, the way a lot of these, you know, traditional lending protocols work is they take in a token, you know, they'll it's like kind of dual purpose. You're lending it and then also collateralizing it simultaneously. In the case of like Aave, that would be an A token. Compound would be a C token. That's really it, right? It kind of just sits there unless someone wants to borrow it. Obviously, these models have been improved a lot. You know, now there are cases where you can lend something but not collateralize it, or collateralize something but it can't be borrowed. But, you know, for us, we completely changed our architecture. So rather than having like the underlying assets be these like conventional ERC-20 tokens, it's these ERC-4626 vaults, which was very challenging because one of the like oldest cases of people building in DeFi is don't put ERC-4626 contract tokens in a lending market. You will get exploited, right? So there was like a whole list of like things like, are we capable of getting screwed from this? Are, you know, can we get hacked this way? Like, can North Korea steal everyone's money that way? Like, you know, just going down the list of all these things. And that was like a Herculean task to really like combine the two things fundamentally, right? We couldn't just take someone else's tech and throw these like vault tokens in and then have everything work. We had to like build everything from the ground up, especially because we didn't want to lose functionality, right? Like, well, maybe you could support those tokens, but now maybe it's inefficient in all the other avenues, right? Now it's not as good for USDC or for regular ETH or whatever. So we had to basically, you know, there are periods where we would look at like Compound's code or, you know, Aave's code or Maker's code, or, you know, how are Oracle's used in this thing? Or how does Uniswap, you know, effectively like, you know, price these, like the different like swap curves, you know, moving around like from like different concentrated liquidity tick rate stuff. Like, we would look at other people's stuff, absolutely. But we never, like, used anyone's code as a base. We basically started with an empty file and, you know, just started coding. So the, you know, what the architectural design kind of changes ended up looking like is we separated the tokens into, like, a position token and basically an earning token, a lending token. We are now trying to combine them back together, which is, like, another new problem that we're introducing for ourselves. So that way we could get all this new functionality and then also have, like, the kind of tried and true, like, a token style experience that you have on, like, Aave or Compound or whatever. But we're able to, you know, expand to all these, like, yield bearing strategy tokens, right? Put liquidity in a DEX and auto compound it or deploy liquidity. Like, for example, we could easily support Aave A tokens as collateral if we wanted to, right? Probably should talk to them about, you know, that or Go or these different types of things. So it's a very different product fundamentally in the asset selection, how we handle risk in terms of, like, liquidating people, and how even collateral is processed in the platform. Because you can use Curvance as a non-lending protocol. For example, maybe you want to farm some LP token and it can't be collateralized, or maybe you just don't want to collateralize it and you could just deposit but not turn it on as collateral. And now you're just benefiting from this strategy that has your assets pooled with everyone else's. And then it's almost like an auto compounder, like a beefy or something like that. Or maybe you don't care about any of those strategy tokens and you just want a conventional lending protocol. And then it's, you know, more like a conventional lending.
When you guys are taking what is ostensibly just a ton of functionality and a ton of, like, features, I think, like, the one downside of having so much composability and so much modularity is that that's, like, a lot of stuff to cram into a front end to show to users. Because I think, like, you know, on one hand, like, institutional depositors, I think, would really appreciate a lot of that functionality. But, like, you know, not everything needs to be for users. So my question for you guys is, how are you guys looking at, like, your front end? Because I think that there's what the protocol can do, and then there's, like, what you show your average regular retail user. And then maybe is there, like, a Curvance Pro model where you have more of, like, the advanced features, stuff like that? Like, I'd love to learn more about how you guys are presenting this functionality.
Yeah, that's actually a fantastic question. So I would say that our UX, you know, the way we've kind of presented everything, the UI has changed a lot over time. You know, it started as us trying to build, like, you know, our own very unique interface, trying to running counter to, like, how a lot of, like, conventional Web3 interfaces are, and cramming in a ton of information that was too much. So then we started pulling out some information. Then we found we weren't, you know, displaying enough. So then we, you know, started adding more in, and we tried to, you know, build, like, modals where, you know, you could select many different options. And it was, like, very explicitly clear, excuse me, what you were trying to do. But then it took up a lot of space. Then it was, you know, a little bit overwhelming to users. So then we figured out how to, like, consolidate, like, the modals. Like, this next few weeks, we have, like, a new set of modals coming out, for example, just that. The next, like, month and a half, I would say overall will be highly focused on, like, UI UX, like, preparation for mainnet. We're very excited about where we're getting to there, but I think it's been something that never in a million years would we have been able to get it right the first time. And I still, like, when I look at our UI UX, people are very kind. They say it's very good. I think it's, like, a 5 or 6 out of 10 right now. There's, like, so much room for us to improve there. But I think it just has to be very iteratively done. And I think, you know, probably what ends up happening is kind of what you were alluding to there with, like, almost like the way I would conceptualize it would be like a Coinbase versus Coinbase Pro approach, where, or advanced, as I think they call it now. That model, you know, kind of self-selects, right? Like, the person can decide, like, well, I don't care about any of these, like, bells and whistles. I want to just buy Bitcoin or whatever they're going to do on Coinbase, right? Versus someone that's like, I want, like, a trading view chart. I want to be able to ladder my orders. You know, I want, once those orders are done, I want to set limits and they're going to behave this certain way, like, much more sophisticated stuff. So some of that stuff, like, outside of, like, our initial scope here. But I think we, you know, eventually want to support both segments. I think out of the gate, our choice here, our decision here is really to focus on like one really good experience that speaks to like the average crypto native. And then as we see what's successful, where user demand is, and we kind of get our legs under ourselves, you know, move towards product market fit, then we can look at, well, how could we expand that? Like one of the things that I think about, for example, is right now today, if you were to use Curvance, it's a very conventional dApp, right? You select, you know, I'm going to be in this, I want to put stuff in this market, I'm going to deposit, and I'm going to deposit this token, right? Click, 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 click. Whereas I think in the future, as people, you know, people have been talking recently about like this agentic technology, like AI, or, you know, just generally the way I would think about it is like, you want to describe what you want to do and like have all the bells and whistles kind of handled behind the scenes. So that might look like I have $1,000, you know, I want something low risk. So it's not like a new fringe protocol on some new fringe, you know, ecosystem. It's like Aave or something, right? And I want it something that doesn't move around in price a lot, right? So it should be like a stable coin, not, you know, like some altcoin that goes up or down 20% in a day, right? And then it would say, okay, I'm going to take your $1,000 and I'm going to put it into USDC and I'm going to go lend it on Aave, and you know, then you could collateralize that and, you know, do whatever you want on Curvance if you want, right? So that's obviously a very different user flow. I think like that secondary model makes a lot of sense for the future, where, you know, down the line, I view crypto blockchain very broadly as going the same way the internet did, where the early adopters used things like root access. You know, they had to have the know-how of how to access the internet, the inner workings there and stuff. But nowadays, you know, no one needs to know that stuff, right? Like they know if they type in facebook.com, their Facebook, you know, login is going to pop up. They put in the username and password that they set, you know, either they have it memorized or it's saved, you know, on their computer in like the password manager, or they wrote it down somewhere, or they memorized it, whatever it is. And then they don't need to know any of the inner workings there. They know their, you know, friends list is going to pop up and they can message them or post pictures or whatever. Like all of the inner workings have been completely obfuscated from, you know, the person. And that's just not where we're at today, but I think it's where we're going, right? So that's like embedded wallets. That's, you know, describing, you know, what you want to do from like a risk profile, you know, standpoint, rather than being like, I'm going to be in this USDC LP pair or whatever, like complicated stuff, like all that's going to get extracted away from the user down the line.
I think that
kind
makes
a
lot of
answer
sense.
Answer to your question, but that's like,
no, it's a
where
perfect
we are,
answer.
Where we're going, and you know, where the future kind of aims to be.
I think that's a very good future. You know, I think like one of my nightmares is like accidentally forgetting to turn off like one of these things and just like talking, and then, you know, Siri on my phone picks up something and mishears me and is like, all right, we are now selling all of your ETH and going super long on, you know, like Dogecoin. I do think that's definitely the future. I think that you know, the question is going to be, you know, how do we get there? But I am very much, I think you already know, like, you know, our company Fastlane is also very much building towards a future where a lot of the inputs are coming from more like, you know, agentic sources. So let me ask you this though. So like, you guys have a very different take on, let's call it risk. And I was actually listening to a podcast the other day, and I was hearing a bunch of engineers talking about like stable coins and rehypothecation. And I didn't hear of, not a single time did I hear anyone bring up the concept of financial contagion, you know? And so whenever I think about risk, especially with like lending protocols, one of the main things that worries me is this concept of, you know, financial contagion, where a collapse in one area causes the value of another area to also go down to zero. And then all of a sudden, because that area was collateral for a third, you start having the systemic collapse, you know, a liquidation cascade, so to call it. And so for me, you know, when I put my TradFi regulator hat on, I start to look at the insane velocity of capital through DeFi ecosystems, which is anywhere from like, you know, 20 to 50 times higher than TradFi. And all of a sudden, all of these liquidation cascades, all of these problems that are just top of mind after 2008, after the, you know, financial crisis. Like, those problems start to look very real, especially as the stablecoin TVL or AUM, whatever you want to call it, increases. And so I guess, like, my question for you is, first of all, how do you feel about just financial contagion in general, especially in the context of DeFi? And then the follow-up question would be, what are you guys doing differently to take that into consideration?
That's a tough question.
It's a loaded question. It's a very loaded question.
For sure. I think that, you know, it's interesting because, like, so much of crypto, like, the industry is going through the same development that other, I guess, industries have gone through, right? Like, traditional finance has obviously had, you know, tons of, like, wipeout events. And I think in general, people don't care about this stuff until they do, you know, as they say, right? So it's like, no one really cared about, like, the potential fallout of, like, algorithmic stable coins, these, like, partially backed, you know, things until Luna blew up, right? And then everyone's like, oh, well, now we should never do algorithmic stable coins again, right? But it's like, well, if you looked at, you know, like, history, like, there was a reason why there was, like, the gold standard and, you know, like, the negatives of, like, reserve banking, like, partial reserve banking, right? Like, where you could have a bank run, right? Which is essentially what happened to, you know, Luna with UST, right? Like, they were under collateralized because they were paying out, you know, additional yield on top. And, you know, eventually many people wanted to get out all at once. And there obviously wasn't enough money for it in the same way that if everyone tried to withdraw from a bank, they couldn't. And things blew up, right? Now, of course, there's regulatory, you know, help, right, in the traditional markets that prevent, like, those outcomes. Whereas crypto, you don't have any guardrails, right? As you said. So, like, once something goes bad, it goes really bad, really fast, right? So, it's like the perfect negative storm. People don't care about, like, or undersubscribe on risk until things happen. And then they happen really fast. As you said, even like the velocity of money being like 20 to 50 times higher, that exacerbates it too.
One of the things I think is really interesting is that I feel like when I talk about these kinds of things with people from TradFi, they like immediately grasp it. Meanwhile, I feel like a lot of the loudest voices in crypto just haven't like seen a lot of these things happen in TradFi. And so like they'll reinvent certain things that very much are already in existence and that we've kind of already see play out. And it always worries me when I hear like engineers who have, you know, zero history or like, you know, have not spent time studying TradFi. When I hear them like, you know, talking about like risk parameters and things like that, because I think like realistically, you know, there are very real problems. And like you brought up the like the Luna depeg. For me, the one that I always go to, in addition to the Luna depeg, was when USDC depegged, because what we saw was actually financial contagion coming in from the opposite direction. Because it is, it's a two-way street, right? And we saw that one of the banks that had was being used as collateral for USDC. Ended up, over the weekend, SVB didn't have full collateral, and so USDC depegged. And liquidations based off of USDC depegging, if USDC was like the collateral asset, then like all of a sudden you've got like a whole bunch of like, you know, things going on, like second order, and you started to see liquidations. And so there was just a lot of like really interesting stuff. And it's a two-way street, right? Whenever you're tying these DeFi things to these TradFi things, it's a two-way street. Like, you know, we can take out TradFi, but TradFi can also take out DeFi. And there's that like codependency and there's that financial contagion there. And I find it very interesting to study that, especially with, yeah, like the velocity of capital in crypto.
Yeah, I think the other thing that I see too is that a lot of products in crypto focus very heavily on one segment of volatility, right? So what I would say is there are some products that are really good when volatility is low, right? But then they blow up when volatility is high, or they do really well when volatility is high and then they blow up when volatility is low, right? Like perfect example of that would be like a lot of tokens that generate, you know, revenues and usage and stuff off of like trading volumes, right? But like as soon as those trading volumes, you know, evaporate, like the value of the token, the rewards they're giving is tied to that volume. So it basically gets like double screwed and then the, you know, protocol goes out of business, right? versus like there are some that maybe build these really good models for periods of low volatility, but like instantly blow up when there's some like massive liquidation cascade, like we saw in like early February of this year, right? Where ETH like, you know, wicked down like 20-30%, right? So, you know, nothing's really perfect. We've done our best trying to like accommodate both, you know, paradigms of volatility, both, you know, I guess like, you know, like segments, both business segments there, in terms of like, how do you take good care of borrowers and lenders in periods of both low volatility and high volatility? And that needed like a lot of dynamic on-chain math and some of this like off-chain compute around like there are order flow auctions that, you know, we're building with you guys, funnily enough. So
what a coincidence.
You know, that's yeah. So that's definitely one piece. You know, just broadly, I think that in general, it's important that people understand like the totality of risk that like a product has, and kind of discount that product as a result of that. So what do I actually mean by that kind of word salad there? There's a lot of cases where we'll be building Curvance, and then someone will come to us and be like, well, what, you know, are you guys going to add this? This other team's doing that. And I'm like, well, like if this bad thing happens, then that thing's going to blow up. And then like 6 months later, that thing blows up, right? But it's like, especially once we're alive and the product's out there, there's kind of this annoyance where someone could potentially do better than us locally because they're just completely undersubscribed on risk. But then obviously when things blow up, they blow up. But during the period where that thing didn't happen, now we're at a competitive disadvantage, right? So that's one thing that's annoying, where it's like people don't do that quite as much in TradFi because there's all the like regulations and stuff that you need to, you know, kind of play within, whereas in crypto, that's not there yet.
Yeah. And I think one of the things a lot of crypto people don't realize is that all of the regulations in TradFi exist for a reason. No one was just like, all right, let's just put up these blockades just because. Like every single one of them exists because someone somewhere lost a lot of money in a way that they didn't expect. And so I always find it like fascinating to see like a lot of people market certain products as like ways to bypass regulations without necessarily explaining how they are solving for the problem that those regulations are designed to mitigate. It always worries me when people.
That's something that that James at Category Labs talks about a lot, is like, is the thing you're building in crypto like fundamentally good technology, or is it regulatory arbitrage, right? Which I think for us, like the answer is it's very much not regulatory arbitrage, and is a market improvement. Cause like fundamentally what we do better is like the code can price risk much more effectively and scalably and deploy liquidity, you know, across many users at once. Otherwise you'd need 5,000, 10,000 people to like manage all these individual things. It's just not scalable, right? So I think it's important to, as you said, kind of step out and then objectively look at like, is this thing trying to, you know, be like regulatory arb, or is it actually solving a real problem in the world?
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So like for you guys, when you are looking at approaching this, something that you had mentioned before just like really resonated with me, which is that you've got this like local maxima where people can have higher local maxima because of their disregard or mispricing of risk, which I've always viewed as like somewhat of a collective action problem. And the regulations that are in TradFi exist to help us mitigate this collective action problem, this, you know, game theory tragedy of the commons type thing. And so one of the things that always worries me in particular with your segment of like, you know, lending protocols in particular, is that if that happens in your segment, it has the potential to take out the entire ecosystem with it, as we saw with Luna. And so it's like, on one hand, it's like, you know, with a DEX, for instance, if a DEX is doing something stupid, then like, okay, you know, maybe they're getting a lot of volume, but then people are like, wow, all of this impermanent loss or LVR is bad. And so people stop using it, but the ecosystem will mostly be fine afterwards. But with lending protocols, if the number one, like most active lending protocol, which on Monad looks to be you guys, if that lending protocol like has that local maxima like issue where they're just mispricing risk, then they could take out the entire fucking ecosystem with them. And that terrifies me. But that's also one of the reasons why I'm so bullish on Curvance, fair disclosure for the people listening, I am an angel investor in Curvance. I think that, you're a very technical person. You come from TradFi. You have that background. I think one of my favorite things about the Monad team is that they also have backgrounds where they can really like appreciate the kinds of like very opinionated and very well thought out, rational, deliberate choices that you guys are making. And because like, honestly, candidly, there's a lot of lending protocols where I worry that they might, I don't know, maybe I'm like being overly pessimistic, but I think it's like really important for an ecosystem to have a lending protocol that has a very pragmatic, but like level-headed understanding of this kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think that what you're talking about fundamentally isn't so much lending protocols in isolation, but more so leverage, right? Because it's obviously lending protocols give you access to leverage in the same way that perpetuals do, right? So it's like if you had like a massively successful perpetual venue that also is mispricing risk, like those things could, you know, very quickly it can move in the wrong direction, right? As we saw with, you know, cases like on Hyperliquid with the Jelly token, where their open interest, my understanding, I might be butchering this, but my understanding is the way they manage the open interest for a potential contract is in dollars, but it's quoted in token number. So when Jelly went down a lot in price, the open interest in dollars was, you know, roughly staying the same or probably went down, but didn't go down enough. So then someone was able to open up a position of like 30, 40, 50% of the circulating market cap. And that's when that person, you know, the different centralized exchanges, it seems like, obviously I don't have any proof of this or no one really knows, but it looked like the centralized exchanges were suddenly trying to like then hunt, you know, the HLP, the Hyperliquid, you know, vault. Because they instantly listed like perpetuals for that token like within hours, which they never do, right? So there was clearly some like adverse selection there. So I think it could happen with perpetuals as well. Not so much like pulling, you know, the target off of ourselves, but you know, I agree with you. I think that in general, it's a case of like you need to more accurately price risk, and there's a lot of ways to do that, right? It doesn't necessarily mean like don't take as much, you know, collateral in or something like that, but also like being able to more accurately handle spikiness in price action. Like, so for example, with us, one of the things we're going to be introducing is multiple markets with the same asset configuration. So that might be like depositing, say, wrapped Bitcoin and borrowing USDC. But, you know, one of those might have a LTV loan to value ratio of, say, 95% and be a tiny pool. And then another one at, say, 93% and a larger pool. And then another one at 91% and so on. So if you have very fast price movement, you know, you have that first, you know, call it tranche, the 95% one that would get liquidated first, you know, before the 93%, before the 91% and so on. So it like much more accurately can offload risk, right? It's not like you have a, you know, gajillion dollars that all gets liquidated at the same time. And now like there's not enough liquidity for that single moment in time. It lets you kind of like split it up over time. And to me, that was like a very easy addition, right? You're just kind of replicating just like you would a database, right? You're kind of like copy pasting the same thing a few times. It might be a little bit annoying for, you know, potential lenders that now they have to be like, okay, well, what's the interest rate in the 95 versus the 93 versus the 91? I'm sure someone will make an optimizer for that though. And, you know, fix that problem. But like that to me is like an easy, you know, fix for reducing the risk that like a lot of people don't look at. So I think it's just an exercise in like understanding, like, you know, what's the worst possible scenario that could happen here? Oh, well, like ETH going down 20% from some massive liquidation cascade, that would be really bad. Like, are we going to be okay if that happens? Well, like, let's try to figure that out. And then you could figure out like how you could support these very heavy, you know, changes in price very quickly. So I think that's like specifically on our side. The other thing I wanted to briefly touch on was, you know, around like the Monad side. Initially, you know, I've known parts of the team for, around 3 years now. It was probably 2.5. I think it was like the 3 ETH Denvers ago was when I first met Keone and some of the other Monad team members. And, you know, they have a bunch of people that are ex-Jump, you know, so they're more on like that kind of like high frequency trading, you know, side, but still like very quantitative in nature, just like myself. And I think that like resonated a lot with me. It was like, oh, like we have this kind of like shared camaraderie versus our like previous industry. And now we're working in this new, exciting, you know, industry that, that we're very, I guess, optimistic about. And I think that was like that kind of, shared, experience that, that let us, you know, grow, you know, closer than maybe typical.
That resonates with me. I think from my point of view, there's a lot of just like maxis out there who build blockchains where they're just like, this is going to be the blockchain that is this or that. And meanwhile, the Monad team is just like, you know, a whole bunch of quants, and they're just building like the optimal blockchain on like, you know, a multidimensional, like, you know, trade-off spectrum. I love the choices that they make because they're all very logical rather than rooted in some sort of like, you know, prescription to some, you know, subjective ideal. It, you know, it's very rational, very reasonable. And
it's also not so much about, you know, just decision-making. Like, I think that's obviously one part of it, but I would go even a step further of like, if there isn't a clear, you know, A or B, you know, decision to make, like they'll build their own solution that fits the, you know, the bill better, right? Like, for example, with like MonadDB being like a better database for storing like these Merkle root, you know, I mean, I'm not as quite as familiar on like the blockchain architectural side as you are, but you know, when they felt that there was like a market improvement that they could make by making something new, they did it, right? Which resonated with me a lot because like that's the same thing we did, right? Like we probably could have got most of the way there from a product standpoint by like forking someone else's code and, you know, again, trying to make like incremental improvements, but like by basically completely scrapping everything and starting essentially with like a blank notepad file, you know, you're able to much more intelligent be like, these are the things I need this, you know, protocol to do. And you build the foundation, the building blocks, you know, brick by brick, instead of starting with like, you know, this pretty good foundation and then building a house on top. We built the foundation and we built the house in the same way that they did here, right? Like, as you said, you know, it's like, what are the best ways to, you know, solve these problems? And if there isn't like that great of a choice for us to make today, can we build something as a better solution for tomorrow?
I love that. Like, and they've rebuilt all of like the core parts of the stack too, which I find to be so fascinating. Like Monad BFT is something I'm a particular fan of. They've solved a lot of problems that like are very nuanced, I would say, that like a lot of problems that most people don't even know exist. And you have to be really deep into like the MEV space to kind of know that some of these problems are out there. And they've, you know, spent engineering time solving these problems in a way that, you know, might not be easy to understand, but that are going to be directly translated into like, you know, better spreads, better fills, you know, better UX, et cetera, for users. And I'm very, very optimistic about, you know, their ability to keep doing that. It's like keep shipping, you know, big upgrades that will have a big impact on the overall user experience. When it comes to you guys, you know, I'm sure you were looking at like a lot of different chains. Monad really jumped out at you, and for largely the reasons that you're bringing up. Is there anything in particular, like any piece of the architecture in particular that you find to be just a huge benefit for you? And I know like in the very beginning of the podcast, we talked briefly about the TPS and how you guys are just like really looking to test out that part. So you have a big dependency, maybe not dependency, but like a big preference. Yeah. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So, I'll speak on it in two different ways. Like the first is pretty straightforward, which is these like managed strategy components, right? Where you're essentially like auto compounding a strategy. The more frequently you can basically increment, reinvest interest, like you just get net higher APRs, right? So like a 7% raw APR on Monad will be higher than a 7% APR on Ethereum, assuming you are compounding at an increased rate than other people, right? So like they would basically be half, they would have to use something like Curvance versus like, you know, them just managing it themselves. Otherwise they would be at a disadvantage because we would be, you know, reinvesting more quickly. So there's just like a, actual improvement to yield in that sense. But I think the more interesting or compelling piece for us is specifically around throughput. You know, part of that being like TPS, single slot finality, but also even just block space in general. Because there's a lot of chains now that are, it's one of the things that rubs me the wrong way a little bit when I look on social media, because everyone's like, oh, well, now everyone has like a 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 TPS blockchain. But one, that's really not the case, because you have a lot of these like kind of WebSocket chains that, you know, now are coming to market, which are very different products. Or two, they have really high TPS, but their blocks size is really tiny. So like their 10 blocks, 50 blocks might be the same size as like one Ethereum block or something. So it's kind of like a misnomer that they actually, you know, because like the transactions they might be doing might just be very simple transfers, right? That are going to be much cheaper in gas. So you could fit a lot in a block. So then it looks, what if you kind of fudge the numbers a little bit, like it's so much better than, you know, something like Ethereum. Whereas Monad actually, you know, is targeting like, for example, like 1 gig of gas, right, per block. Probably I would expect them to, you know, try to even go above that in time. I think that's like kind of their short-term North Star. You know, so for us, like we've done a lot of work on being able to very quickly, effectively roll up liquidations. You know, what we've been targeting recently is this kind of like using big O notation from like the technical side, like O of one, where if you do one liquidation, it's one collateral transfer, one debt transfer. If you do 1,000 liquidations, it's one collateral transfer, one debt, you know, transfer. So it basically scales infinitely, right? Or at least, you know, until the block limit. So if we have really big blocks, we could fit in a lot of liquidations if we need to. That doesn't mean we're liquidating billions of dollars of, you know, collateral or anything. We might only be skimming, you know, a user's position for a very tiny liquidation, right? But it lets us much more accurately manage risk than having these very spiky, you know, as you described, like these liquidation cascades, the systemic risk where, you know, okay, you're not doing anything and then prices move very quickly and suddenly you're trying to catch up and offload all this risk and you're like blowing up the whole, you know, economy on a blockchain. If we're able to fit, you know, our internal estimates, if, you know, Monad can get to 1 gig of gas and we could get these improvements in, and they have the efficacy that we think they will, we should be able to fit around 20,000 liquidations into one block, I think, you know, all else being equal. And that's like, I think today you might be able to fit like 100 or 200 into a block on Ethereum, right? So you're talking about literally like 100x plus improvement.
Less than that. Less than that, I think. I think like an Aave liquidation is around 800k gas and, you know, 30 million. I know they increased it recently, but like, yeah, it's...
Is it 800k? I was thinking it was for in like the... Because I always try to compare like most optimistic scenario. I thought it like in some cases, if it's like a very focused one, it could be maybe like 400. 450, maybe 500, but I could see it being 800 if you have like a lot of different like things going on there.
I think if everything's cold, like all cold storage access, and we're talking about the like, you know, V2 of Aave, which is what I used to do liquidations on, like,
yeah,
way
V2
back in the day.
Cross margin and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Then has to price everything. Yeah.
Yeah. But
yeah,
let me ask you this.
V3's like, cheaper.
One of the things that you hit on here was, you know, this concept of like, you know, more liquidations, where it's like, you know, more but smaller liquidations being something that is you know, absolutely helpful for your own health, like for the health of the, you know, protocol and the protocol's collateral. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, so when you're doing when you need to manage risk, there's like a few things you need to you know, be cognizant of, right? Like you need to get accurate prices, right? So it needs to be updated very frequently. You need to actually execute the liquidation, right? So like there's the throughput aspect, and then there's like the actual slippage, like the price slippage, right? So it's like, you can't imagine Michael Saylor, you know, had like some $50 billion Bitcoin loan on, you know, some chain. Like you're not going to really be able to effectively liquidate that. Like even if everyone on earth was trying to like nip, you know, I'm going to take 0.001% and I'm going to take 0.004% or whatever, like you wouldn't be able to liquidate that. It would like send the price of Bitcoin down very fast, very quickly, because there's like just not enough liquidity to absorb that. So for us, the improvements we've been able to make have been specifically around price accuracy and this like throughput piece, right? So the last one then becomes that slippage piece. So for us, we've introduced the ability to use two oracles at once. So there's like this redundancy aspect, obviously, if there's misreports and such. But it also takes the better of the two prices in favor of the protocol. So if you're valuing someone's collateral, then it's going to use the lower of the two. If it's looking at their outstanding debt, it's going to use the higher of the two, right? So during periods of like low volatility, that won't really matter that much, right? They're going to virtually be the same price. But if prices are moving very quickly, those oracles, you know, either one might just have higher update, you know, throughput than the other, but also one might catch like, you know, some price discrepancies at a larger rate or a larger weight than the other one. So like the price might move, you know, it might be a little more jagged, right? So maybe one would say 100 and the other one might say like 100.02 or something, right? So not a huge difference, but, you know, enough that may trigger like a liquidation. And if we can be the first one, you know, out the door, it doesn't have to be a massive liquidation where people are suddenly like, you know, their whole position disappears, right? But even if it's a 5% or 10% or some tiny liquidation and we're getting, you know, a series of those out initially, that's going to be a lot safer for obviously the lenders, right? But also even the borrowers, right? Because like it's basically getting some of that, you know, potentially toxic collateral out the door at a more favorable price for them, right? So it's almost like positive slippage for them. And then the second is the, you know, so that's like the pricing improvement. The second is this throughput piece. Obviously, we do a lot of this like off-chain computation and storing all these like different invariant values on-chain via transient storage that we're building in collaboration with you guys. You know, the idea there is if we could internalize that MEV and also bring more accurate data on-chain, right? So rather than hard coding or trying to compute like a liquidation penalty on chain, if we could, you know, do all that work off chain and then bring it on chain, that's going to be a huge execution improvement, especially if we could do that in a decentralized way. That's a huge improvement versus just pure on chain. And, you know, that means more accurate liquidation pricing, which potentially lowers the cost, the penalty that the borrowers pay. And then paired with this, you know, throughput improvement, means that the lenders are safer. So like through a few of these, just, you know, tweaks to the model, obviously it was a lot of work, you know, a lot of times talking with different people, you know, in the space, different partners of ours, but also like even just internal iteration. But we finally got a point, you know, to a point where we feel like we're at pretty much the limit of what you could do. Like, I don't really think there's any way for someone else, there's not really like a Curvance 2 or something that could be released and be like a 2x improvement or something, right? Maybe someone could get gas costs down 5% or maybe, you know, slightly more accurate pricing on like the order flow auctions or something like that. But we've, you know, a lot of people talk about startups trying to get like a 10x better improvement over like the opportunities out there. And I think we've finally been able to do that after around 3 years of work. So.
That's amazing.
Would it be accurate to say that, like, you know, on one hand, as far as like the overall protocol and health of the protocol is concerned, you know, because you're using this multi-oracle approach where you're valuing the collateral at the lower of the two, which means you'll, you know, be more likely to liquidate early if, you know, there's like something concerning and therefore stay healthy. And that, you know, might not be ideal for users. But on the other hand, so like the people getting liquidated, you know, probably don't want to get liquidated. But on the other hand, we also have this, you know, new concept of, you know, I don't want to call it OEV because I know like at this point, you know, it's been iterated on so much more that it's like become something else entirely.
Specific. Yeah. Yeah. I just conceptualize as like order flow auctions because that's what you're doing. It's like the same thing that like Robinhood would do, right? Where like they'll sell, you know, user order blocks to Citadel or Jane Street or whoever. It's just the parties are slightly different here. You know, it might be like market makers or some like MEV searcher or, you know, something like that. So I think fundamentally it is much more like TradFi in nature than like purely like, you know, when I think of OEV, I think about it as, you know, like you have an Oracle provider and they're going to hold back that price update until, you know, like some, you know, like MEV is basically extracted from it, which is almost more like price imperfection than anything, right? Because you're delaying an Oracle price versus, you know, actually like processing the liquidation. For us, I think the way we've been able to get around all that is like we can still have Oracle price updates and stuff like that, but there's just a very minor buffer on when the auction-based liquidation could go through versus a you know, permissionless on-chain one, right? Like I think the number we have currently is 10 basis points or 0.1%, which is very tiny.
Yeah, that's like the liquidation bonuses on like, you know, other lending protocols are just orders of magnitude higher.
Yeah, so there's some that are like an 8%. So it's like 80 times the size.
Yeah, there's like, you know, it's definitely more than a 10x improvement. Would it be correct to assume that like, you know, even though users might get like liquidated earlier, the fact that the amount of money they're losing during those liquidations is like 80 times less is just like like a net improvement from the user's point of view?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, it's a lot closer to like perfect pricing, right? So like in some cases, it could be like 180 at the cost, or sometimes like it could be, you know, like if maybe one, you know, lending protocol would liquidate for something for 7% and maybe the winning bid in, you know, in our auction is like 2%, right? So it's like, okay, so that'd be like 2/7. So it's going to be like, I don't know, like 28% or something of like the number there, maybe a little more. You know, which is not like an 80x improvement, but still like a market improvement. You know, I think there's really there's two levers that are being pulled here, which is basically the liquidation size, right? So like on a traditional, you know, lending protocol, CDP platform, perps platform, usually it's either half or 100% of your position, right? If you do it on a perps platform, it's just going to close out your whole position, right? I think Hyperliquid's working on some partial liquidation stuff, but like, my understanding is like pretty much every perps platform, when you hit that liquidation level, you're gone, right? On Aave, if you hit a liquidation level, they close out 50%. If it gets really bad, they'll close out 100%, right? You know, there's some, you know, differences there in like how Maker, you know, runs their, you know, liquidations, where they'll like, they do kind of like an on-chain auction that's like a lot slower, but the penalties are insane. Like I remember actually, it might have been like towards the end of March. Like, there was a few people that got liquidated on Maker for like nine figures. It was like 110, 120 million. And they ended up paying like a 10% liquidation penalty for ETH.
Oof.
So, like, oof. You know, they just paid like 10, 11, 12 million dollars in penalties for getting liquidated. Whereas on Curvance, it might be like, you know, 1/100 that or something, right? Or, you know, if there's a lot of volatility, it could be, you know, closer to that, I guess.
And those liquidation penalties are like leaving the protocol and are therefore no longer there as collateral to keep the like collateral as a whole solvent either.
That's a good point too. You know, one thing to think about there is like, how do you use that value that you keep in the ecosystem, right? Could you build like some like assistance fund or insurance fund? You know, maybe there's some bad debt that accumulated, because we could also parallel process regular liquidations with bad debt liquidations. You know, maybe some like really bad event happens that like, you know, like we could have priced risk better, but now none of that money left the ecosystem. So you could just give it back to the lenders, right? So it's like, that's just a much more scalable, you know, bulletproof, you know, model than having it leak out the door.
Would you say that something like that, and I genuinely, for the people listening, I genuinely don't know the answer to this question ahead of time, but would you say that something like that would be able to help like mitigate the potential damage of a liquidation cascade for you guys relative to, let's say, you know, another generic lending protocol?
I think the answer is yes. Like the situation that would come to mind for me is, I remember, this is a throwback, one of the, I think it was the second or third time Curve Finance got hacked. It was the one where it was the Viper reentrancy bug. If you remember, do you remember what I'm talking about? It was like a compiler bug.
I do. I had to learn Viper just so I could arbitrage Curvance, and I will never forgive them.
Curve.
Right.
Power-related Curve.
Oh, thank God you guys don't use Viper, huh?
So during that situation, I remember there were certain pools that, you know, basically all the ETH got drained from them, right? And the hackers were obviously trying to get the transactions through as fast as they could, so they didn't get front run by like other mev bots and whatever. So they were giving like massive bribes to the validators, right? And some of that money, the teams that basically got exploited as a result of that were able to get back because like the validators or, you know, the MEV searchers, you know, just gave the money back out of basically the kindness of their hearts. But there were other validators, you know, other, you know, people that like, they were just like, no, right? Or they just didn't respond or whatever, right? So it's like, in our case, like if you could keep as much of that liquidity kind of under the same umbrella, if that same scenario happens, say there were some, you know, bug or a liquidation cascade or whatever that suddenly created like a massive liquidation opportunity, well, like almost all of that, you know, liquidity right basically in. Just goes right back in. So you're like, okay, well, like that really sucked. Let's make sure that doesn't happen again. Like, let's improve the risk model or, you know, fix the bug or whatever. But then you can just immediately give it back to people versus like trying to chase, you know, hundreds of people down over like a decade to try to get that capital back. So I think it's like, not only is it like an improvement in like the base model, like there is almost this like security angle that, you know, I basically never talk about that, but you're right. In that sense that like, it's like a security, improvement as well.
That's interesting. So I think we've been saying like a lot of nice things about Curvent so far, because I'm obviously a big fan of what you guys are doing and how you're doing it. But I guess like my question for you is, what would you say right now is the biggest thing that you guys need to do? Like, what would you say is your biggest weakness? That sounds like such an interview question, but I guess like internally, what are you guys
really
the most worried
job,
about? What are
you
working on?
Like,
yeah.
That's a good question. You know, I think my opinion on that is specifically around messaging. You know, there was like a huge period, and I think people that have been following Curvance have seen that for a while, where, you know, we basically would get the product to like a state that like we would be really comfortable with, and it, you know, it does a lot. So like, you know, the obvious answer is to try to like kind of carve out your own, like don't relate it to other things, like, you know, talk about it in, you know, your own kind of like abstract sense. Like, here's what we do. Here's the vision, like for, you know, what we think the future, almost like how there's a lot of research that's been done around like how like Steve Jobs pitched, you know, Apple and much more selling like an experience and a viewpoint rather than like selling a computer, right? And I think like that's something that doesn't translate as well over into crypto, where everything is kind of new and like there's definitely a lot of like adverse selection, where there's like a lot of people that just kind of like make up new things, like, oh, we're reimagining this, or they're like misrepresenting their technology or whatever. So whenever, like, you know, from our perspective, we built like a lot of new technology, but like that can rub people the wrong way, where it's like actually better to be like, well, it is like a lending protocol, like obviously we do a ton more, but like that's like the best way to think about it, you know. So like I think kind of like accepting that and like bringing it back to like basics, I guess, in how we think about Curvance, like that was a big misstep or issue that we had that we're still kind of dealing with, in terms of like when, you know, you might ask five people what, you know, what they think of Curvance, what it does, you know, why they should care, whatever, and you might get five different answers, right? Because like we weren't and we haven't been as good on like the, you know, clear-cut messaging side. You know, so we've been trying to do a better job on that side, you know, like improving documentation. We just released our developer docs because we have like around, I think, almost a dozen, or might even be over a dozen teams now that are looking to build things on top of Curvance, which is great. You know, so it's like making sure that like they have like a good picture of like how they can do things, what we do, as you said, what are the potential like risk factors, you know, what should you be cognizant of? So I think messaging in my head is the big one. And that's something that like we had to organically kind of find our voice for, and we're still not there yet.
That resonates with me, because I think, for us, that's 100%, you know, hitting the nail on the head for, you know, what Fastlane is also thinking a lot about. One of the recent, rule, I don't want to say like rule, but like one of the recent things that we started talking about internally is no explanation of a product can require one of the words used in that explanation to have to be explained. So like no explaining something in terms of something else
that also needs an explanation, because we have a really bad habit of doing that, of just having like nested, like intellectual dependencies. And so we're trying to unroll
that.
I
actually have a perfect example of that. Like right now we're adding like some data visualization stuff to like position health on the front end. So it's like, I have this like ETH deposited and I borrowed USDT. Like, how's that position doing? Am I going to get liquidated? Like, is it healthy? Whatever. It's like right now that's not in the app. And that's something that's important to us to add. So we put together this like, you know, nice little modal, you know, like kind of visual tool. And at first we put it down as like health factor, right? Which is like the many people that are on like the developer side or, you know, deeply, you know, involved in DeFi will know like what a health factor is, right? It's like, okay, well, that's something that a lot of lending protocols would use. If you drop below a health factor of one, you get liquidated, right? So it's looking at like how close your collateral is to the liquidation threshold. And I was like, okay, well, those people aren't going to know what the heck of a health factor is. We should say this is your portfolio health, right? Or your market health, right? Because that's like much more related, rateable, right? And then you could even like, it has a visual tool where it's like, when you hit one, you can get liquidated, right? So don't hit one, right? Which is a lot more, I think, relatable to someone that doesn't, you know a lot of these like esoteric, you know, terms that the industry prides itself on. It's like, as you said, like, how do you make it so you can tell someone something without having to like explain the definition itself?
Yeah. I've always wanted a lending protocol when they're doing a health factor to just, you ever play that game Hangman where you try to like guess the word and people pick the letter and you draw like another, like, you know, part of the dude.
Like a body, an arm. Yeah.
I'd love for like a health factor to have something like that, where it's just like the lower it gets, like the more drawn the person is inside of that thing. It's a little bit morbid, but I feel like there's a lot of room for just like, you know, slightly nonsensical things to play around with there to convey ideas. One of the other things that I think is like, and this might resonate with you, but from my point of view, one of the reasons why I'm like really frustrated, I don't say frustrated, but just like, yeah, I guess frustrated is the right word, with a lot of the ways that some apps describe things, is that they'll use words that have one meaning in TradFi and another meaning in DeFi. I think slippage is probably the most egregious like example of something that means something different in those two systems. And like for me, like that's always been something that is like made it difficult for me to understand certain things. And so for us, it's like a big focus, yeah, on just like simplifying things so that as more and more institutional people and as more and more, you know, like non-DeFi native people start coming in, they can, you know, interact with, you know, like us, but like, you know, everybody, in a way that is easy to understand. Like I've joked about this a lot, but I really want my grandma to be able to like understand intuitively just from like reading the words, what it is that some of this stuff does. And I think that's an interesting design goal for us. And it's like, it's really refreshing to hear you guys say that too.
Because
it's so hard.
Well, it's exacerbated because there's so many different, like the idea of crypto blockchain in general is like financial rails for everyone, right? So like, as you said, when you were talking earlier about like TradFi and, you know, like regulations and stuff, it's like for a segment of the populace that is familiar with the stuff, knows why these things are required. Like there's a burden of knowledge there to some degree, right? Whereas theoretically the idea here with crypto is that anyone can use it, right? So there's no burden of knowledge, right? So you have to be able to communicate to the most sophisticated actor, unsophisticated actor, and everyone in between, right? And that's like a very tall order task.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that's where all the real alpha is in building an app these days, is being able to have a description that's like a very wide net. So we're coming up on the end of the podcast. Last question before we go, what's the alpha? What should we be looking out for? Is there anything coming down the Curvance pipeline soon that is worth paying attention to? Like, obviously everything's worth paying attention to, but that's like worth like really diving deep into that people can get really excited about, or stuff that people should be excited about, but maybe haven't been like fully brought across yet.
Sure. Yeah. So I think over the next like month and a half, we're doing like a lot of UI UX improvements that we've been, you know, constantly like sharing with the community, you know, things like Telegram, on our Discord. You know, so I think like overall the experience of the application is like the big focus for us now. you know, obviously when we initially did our rollout on a Monad testnet, we ran into like a lot of scaling issues just because there's such a huge influx of users. Like I think we peaked with one day having like 150-something thousand unique users.
That's awesome.
Which is a lot, you know, for, you know, when you think about like Ethereum, I think daily has like around 400,000 daily active users, something like that. You know, then if you add in like all these other chains and stuff, like, you know, probably gets a bit higher. But that's like a lot, right? Like that's much more than like a typical application will ever see like in a single day. So we had to very quickly, you know, pivot our focus to like scaling solution stuff. But now all that's done, right? Like most of the features in the application are already in terms of like product features. There's a few more we're adding, but it's largely UI UX now. So I think now is the time to actually make the app, you know, look good, feel good. We have like light mode, dark mode selection coming to the application. Nice. We're cleaning up like the navigation and things, like adding like a tutorial to the app, like a guidance, you know, as we're talking about it. So that's, you know, coming into the pipeline too. There's a lot of visual improvements. Yeah, just like a ton of, I guess, like experiential things that like we're trying to actively get feedback from the community on. So, you know, if people are, you know, in especially like the Discord, there's like the opportunity to kind of like, you know, shape that design to some degree. You know, but outside of that, you know, barreling towards launch here, you know, we're going to more tangibly share like, you know, a lot of the math and like the features and like why we think, you know, Curve Ants is important through like a traditional white paper, you know, a bit before launch here. So we'll be launching that for the more technically minded that want to, you know, review things like that. Yeah, I mean, we're kind of towards the end of development here, finally, you know, and moving towards launch with Monad. So exciting times here.
That's awesome. For the people at home, so your website is curveants.com, correct?
Yep. Yeah, we have a commercial link there. So not .fun or .io or .xyz.
That's awesome. That is awesome. Well, dude, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you so much for the deep insights. I really appreciate your willingness to get like, you know, to really roll up your sleeves and dive deep into the technical aspects and like the, you know, financial engineering aspects of a lot of this stuff. I think a lot of people oversimplify the lending space and don't really realize just how much like math and how much mechanism design there is that can like really help it 10x. And I personally, you know, I think you already know this, but like I personally am just such a huge fan of you guys just doing so much heavy lifting in order to make them like, you know, Monad ecosystem a safer place and also to make the experience for users both more rewarding, like bluntly in terms of yield, but also just like more holistic and more composable. I think what you guys are doing is amazing and I can't wait to see what's next.
Kind words, sir. That's cool. Exciting times here and look forward to everything you guys roll out on Monad as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, dude, thank you so much and talk again soon.